back to Shatteringness. We're going to turn our attention to the Torah. It's a book that we don't very often consider because it's got a lot of detail in it, but there's not typically a lot of new learning in it. Although we have been a bit focused on this book. It's called Numbers in your English translations. It's about Midbar in the wilderness in Hebrew. And the remedy for venomous snake bites that Yosha cited in Yohanan 3, John 3, came from Numbers. And probably the single most cited, what they would consider to be Old Testament, it just happens to be the Torah. In fact, the single most cited Torah passage in churches is this one that we're moving up to, but you wouldn't recognize it based upon what Yahweh actually said. And that's really how you stumbled on it, isn't it, Kirk?
Yes, sir, it was. And when you read the two, it was like a better translation, at least. You just kind of almost shocked because it's so pretty. It's so pretty in the... The closer you get to what he actually said, the better it looks, and the other is just not much.
Yes, it's may the Lord keep you and bless you. May his face to shine upon you. You know, that's the way that it is presented in the Christian churches, and it's really interesting. Of course, they would present in a Christian church because what did Paul have to say about the Torah?
Well, it's worthless. It doesn't save. It doesn't help. In fact,
worse than worthless. He called it destructive. He called it paneros, the basis of pornography, in English.
Yeah, well.
And said that it enslaves and that those who try to achieve salvation through the Torah, that it's completely impotent. It not only cannot save, but, for example, if you're circumcised in accordance with the covenant, then you can't be saved, according to Paul. I mean, Paul's view of the Torah was to trash it. And so why would they be quoting this passage when it comes out of the Torah?
Well, how do you stand up and preach something like that in front of a crowd when you can read the absolute contradiction almost everywhere you go in the Torah, Provenance, Psalms, and also in everything Yosha said, this is that the Torah is true. I mean, you got Dode saying just the opposite. I mean, come on. This is kind of strange. It's bizarre, really, when you think about it.
Yeah, they love to talk about David as a hero type and mm-hmm. the battle of the against Goliath and the like. And by the way, and when he did engage with Goliath, was it a bloody, brutal affair where they were engaged in hand-to-hand combat?
Oh, no, it was just a quick one and out.
Yeah, how many stones?
Well, he took five, and I've heard because he had some brothers just in case. I guess he maybe thought he had to do the other, but he only took one stone to knock him out.
Yeah. He took five, of course, because he's a representative of what it means to be part of the covenant, and there's five conditions of the covenant. There are five benefits of the covenant. We have five fingers on our hand. There are five hands in Yahweh's name. Five is a really important number as it relates to Yahweh and to getting to know him. So he took five. The first one did the trick. And yet, you know, the most famous line from Dode is his 23rd Psalm. And they love to speak of the 23rd Psalm, but they corrupt it to the point where they take out 100% of the meaning. It's just, you know, it becomes a nursery rhyme. Of course, the 23rd Psalm is about being a sheep in Yahweh's flock. It is the visual representation of what the letters in Hebrew actually say that help us understand the meaning of the words. The very, you know, the shepherd's staff, the ram's head that we've been talking about, all of that.
Right.
And being nurtured and fed and protected provided water and food and the like. And the 23rd Psalm is all a visual depiction through what the letters themselves convey. So it's powerful from that point of view. What I want to do is let me just read to our listeners where we were on this, on Devarim and Bamidbar, excuse me, and then we'll pick it up with an ongoing translation. And to secure and enlarge a home and meeting place, this is Wah, Yahweh, which is an outstretched hand, a person reaching up, the safe enlargement of a home and family, and a person reaching up is the letters that comprise the name. The hand of the eternal existing one reaching down and out to those standing up, engaged, looking up, and reaching up to him so they can be made secure under his protection, increased every way in his home. And Yahweh, he elected to speak the eternal word as God to influence Moshe. And this is Debar, which we said this is the observant individual finds the doorway into Yahweh's home and becomes part of his family, is the three letters of Debar. And Moshe is the one who draws out to approach by promising, by answering, by saying. And then this is the next line. It says, speak to prompt a decision, again, Debar, to Aharon, which means enlightened free will, and to his sons, to draw near by communicating, La Amar, this demonstrative frame of reference, Ko. You shall always bless, benefiting by lifting up in love, positively and eternally influencing, accordingly, the children of Yisrael. So we talked yesterday about Barak.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just go over the three letters of Barak and how that frame of reference, because he just talked about a frame of reference. Here is the antithesis of the religious frame of reference, but yet is the only accurate frame of reference relative to God.
Mm-hmm. Well, Barak, of course, has starts out with a B sound from the Bet, which is the shape of a or a bird's eye view of a tent with a one entrance, but duly noted. And then you also have
which means family and home.
Family and
in fact,
home.
The letter itself. The pronunciation of the letter is the Hebrew word Be'eth, which means family and home. And it's the basis of Be'reth, which is the covenant, which means that the covenant is a family-oriented relationship.
Mm-hmm. Followed by R, which is the Rosh, and it's depicted as a head, a servant head, one you engage with your eyes and you shamar, and you know, use your brain to study.
Yeah, by the way, you know, one thing we didn't talk about on the Rosh, but bears saying, is that the letter Rosh is one of those letters that has a primary meaning that is ever so slightly different than its depiction. Like Be'eth, for example, is a depiction of a home, and it means home and family. Primary meaning and the meaning of the letter itself and the depiction exactly the same.
Mm-hmm.
Rosh, primary meaning is first and foremost.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it gets first and foremost by being head and top.
Right.
So it means first, beginning, head, top, foremost. So what we're talking about is from an observant point of view, that should be your priority.
Yeah.
First and foremost, you ought to be observant. And if you're not observant, first and foremost, you ain't ever going to get there. You have to start with being observant. In the beginning, you need to be observant. You need to pay attention to what Yahweh had to say to us, or you'll never become part of his family. You'll never come to know him. So that's first and foremost. It also means that's the top priority.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you ought to prioritize. So that's where you need to start. That's what you need to prioritize. And we're talking about here the first family.
Mm-hmm. And it means beginning, too. So, I mean, that's where you begin. So
that's where you begin. That should be your priority. It should be your focus. And we're talking about the first and top, best, highest. Rosh also means highest family. Just as the head is the highest point of a body that is standing up.
Is there another language where the words actually mean anything?
Or where the letters mean something?
Letters, I mean, mean anything.
Yeah. I'm not aware of one. Yeah, I mean, Arabic is based upon the Hebrew alphabet.
Just redrawn
Hebrew letters, same number of letters, same sound of the letters, same order of the letters. Arabic is nothing but redrawn Hebrew. But I think Hebrew is unique in a lot of ways. I know it was the first actual alphabet where the characters represented sounds.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was the first alphabet where the characters were drawn to symbolize concepts, although Egyptian hieroglyphics were clearly written to convey concepts, although immoral concepts, pagan religious concepts in the case of hieroglyphics. So it's pretty unique in those regards. I don't know of another language. There may be one. Where there is no verb that is stuck in time, where all verbs are eternally true,
yeah.
Which is powerful. I don't know of any other language that has stems that develop relationships between the subject and object. I don't know any other language where many of the verbs convey volition, and that the moods ascribed to the verbs all convey volition of one form or another. First, second, and third person volition,
mm-hmm.
emphasized volition, pausation volition, which means I want you to pause here and then contemplate the consequence of this. And then there's another form of volition that's this is really important, and I want to strongly emphasize it.
That's the causative. Is that what you said?
There's first, second, and third person straightforward volition. I'm saying this. This is, it conveys the will and the choice of the speaker, of the person being spoken to, whether that person being spoken to is referenced in second or third person, you or they. And then there are two forms of Hebrew moods that express volition. Also in first, second, or third person, but they do so with an added bit of emphasis. You know, one says, this is really important. I'm conveying volition again, but I want you to understand that this is very important. And another is that I want you to pause. I want you to consider the choice that is available to you. Yes, so, Kirk, there are... three different primary conveyance of volition in Hebrew, first, second, and third person. And then there's two additional that the imperative, for example, and the paragogic, which primarily convey volition, but also in one case emphasis, in the other case pausation. I just want you to pause and think about the choice that is before you. So, those pretty unique aspects of Hebrew.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's quite an amazing language when you start really looking at it. It's,
it's an artist language, too.
Grammar, but yeah.
Yeah, it's an artist language.
Yeah.
But, if you think of the grammar in Hebrew from two perspectives, then it doesn't become grammar anymore. The stems all establish relationship. Just think of them as relational. It's the subject influencing the object, the subject and object working together, or the object influencing the subject, and there's the active and passive forms of that interaction. So it's just, the stems are strictly relational. Nothing more complicated than relationship. Just think about you and your wife and the influence you have on one another. I mean, she tells you to take out the trash. She has put you into action. She has peeled you in the Hebrew sense. And she says, let's take out the trash. Then she's hiffled you, that you and she are engaged together. That would be the hiffle stem. So if you look at it, just strictly in relationships, then you'll understand Hebrew stems. They're no more complicated than relationships. If she responds positively, if you take out the trash using your own initiative, that would be a passive form of influence. If you do something as the subject, as the object that brings her satisfaction, that would be another form of conveyance of the stems of Hebrew. Okay, so then beyond that, the only other thing you have to think about I guess there's two others. The next one is volition, free will. If you understand the concept of free will, of choice, of desire, of, the moment you get away from law and obey to guide, teach, direct, listen, observe, then you really understand the concept of free will.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so free will, all the moods are an expression of free will. Nothing more. So it's not really a grammatic thing. It's an expression of free will. And the only thing beyond that, really, is that in Hebrew there's a thing called a verbal adjective and a verbal noun where the noun or adjective become actionable.
Mm-hmm.
Where you should see the noun as, or the verb. The verb is either taking on an identity, or the noun becomes actionable, where it's kind of a blend between those aspects. And, think of nouns are names for things, a thing is a noun, and a verb is simply demonstrates some form of action.
Mm-hmm.
Not much more to it than that. And, the conjunctions and prepositions and pronouns. The only thing that is different in Hebrew and just English is that English is one of the unique languages where pronouns and conjunctions and prepositions are separate from verbs.
Mm-hmm.
Most languages, they're not. In most languages, the pronouns, the conjunctions, and the prepositions are integrated into the verb.
Yeah, and then so you have to separate. That's where I get a little trouble. Where I have to separate out, like Baroque. It may be preceded with a yod.
Yes, or followed by a yod. My blessing. Elohim versus or Edon versus Edonai. Mm-hmm. My upright one versus right. The upright one.
Right.
So, that's the nature of Hebrew, is that they are that the prepositions are attached to concepts, to nouns and to verbs. And then the other thing is that most languages have a male and female aspect to most nouns,
mm-hmm.
and it's helpful in that in a sentence structure. You can use a feminine pronoun, and then you have to go back to the previous application of a noun that could be the subject that is feminine as opposed to masculine. So it helps you identify what's being talked about in the pronouns, and it gives a flavor to a concept. Does this concept have a feminine flavor or a masculine flavor, like the Ruach spirit? Feminine. Yeah, feminine. So I think it's a more descriptive language, more precise language. One of my favorite Hebrew words from the graphic depiction point of view is son and daughter, children. BN and BNH for daughter. And the reason is what it conveys. So the Hebrew word for son, how would you convey it? What would you come up with in terms of meaning? Just looking at the letters that create the Vayeth and Nun.
Well, you've got a family home there, and then you have an inheritance or a seed, and the seed being like a sperm, so you're producing...
Yeah, new life.
More children, new life, yes.
Yeah, new life, a child, a new life, and a home setting with an inheritance. So this is not a destitute family. This is a family where you're inheriting something worthwhile, where the inheritance is on par with the new life.
Mm-hmm.
In a family and home. Those are the letters. And all you add to that to be a daughter is the hey.
Hey, which is feminine at the end, regardless.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Stand up, look up, reach up, pay attention. So
we had a K at the end of Barack, right? We had a cough.
Well, we did. Yeah, I'm sorry. Did I? And
I guess I must have hanging out there.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, also, the first letter in the demonstrative frame of reference that precedes Barack Co. has the same K. So what is the what's the frame of reference?
Well,
in Barack?
An open palm is the greeting. Holding, you can grab
right.
with a hand, but it's open. It's a friendly greeting, not a negative one.
So in the first family, in the most important and best top home, as a priority for those who are observant, what we find is a open palm, which provides gifts, which reaches out and love, which welcomes, opening the way into that family. That is the letters that define Barack. And the word means to kneel down in love, to lift up.
Mm-hmm. And also can be offered a gift to another. So, I mean, obviously that's true,
mm-hmm.
too. So.
Yep.
All of this. So if you only went the first two words, you get such a more meaningful, it's so much more meaningful rather than the Lord will bless thee.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. This is,
grab right there.
Right. So this is, in the peel stem. So the peel stem, the subject, puts the object into motion by influencing them by the verb's action. So by being put into motion, if you're reaching out to someone with an open hand, if you're kneeling down in love to lift them up, you're actually influencing them. You're lifting them up.
Mm-hmm.
You're bringing them to you.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right?
So this is not just a passive, you know, like you kneel down before a lord or a king. You're not putting the king or the lord into action. But if you're kneeling down as a father to your children to lift them up, you're putting them into action. That's why this was written in the peel stem. That's the relation that is being created here. It was written in the imperfect. There's only two conjugations in Hebrew, perfect and imperfect. Perfect means a completed action, past, present, or future. Imperfect means ongoing.
Okay.
Habitually, as a practice. So, that's the what was being conveyed and how it was being conveyed. So you should always bless, benefiting by lifting up in love, positively and eternally influencing. Accordingly, this is from Eth, the children of Yisrael. Beni Yisrael. How would you describe Beni Yisrael from the characters? It's B-N-Y, and then we'll go to Yisrael.
Yeah, well, we said... of course, once again, is the B is the home and the family home and the mm-hmm. inheritance family, the nun. So Bini, and if you add a Y or a Yod, then you have the hand reaching down, which again is usually symbolic, or I always immediately think of Yahweh.
Yeah, so a hand reaching down on behalf of the family to the children with an inheritance,
mm-hmm.
Bini. And Yisrael, Yod, Sin, Rosh, Aleph, Lamed.
Now let me ask you a question about that because mm-hmm. I went back. I had written it with the wrong S,
mm-hmm.
and I went back in Strong's and Jacinus and a couple others. They write it with the other S. So I was trying to figure out why, and I couldn't figure out why they...
The shin versus the sin.
No, I was going to say, I didn't know what to do, so I went and I looked up Sarah, and now Sarah's written with the other one, so...
Right, right, and it's based on Sarah.
Why do they do that?
Right.
I don't...
Yeah, and it's interesting here that in Paleo-Hebrew, there are three... S's in Babylonian Hebrew, the Shemek, the Shin, and the Sin. And the Shin and the Sin are differentiated in Babylonian Hebrew by a dot on the left or the right side. The Shin is a letter in Babylonian Hebrew that's written like the English W.
Mm-hmm.
and you put a dot over the right side of the, you know, there's three prongs that go up on a W. Mm-hmm. The furthest right one has a dot over it if, in Babylonian Hebrew, if it's the shin, and the dot on the left side if it's the sin. And then you have the shemek, which is a harder S sound. And in the Hebrew of the graphics that we're talking about,
mm-hmm.
there really isn't there aren't three S's, and there is no such diacritical mark for separating them. But since Sarah began with a sin, which is these this
thorn.
to protect and to pierce. So you pierce right to the heart of the matter, and this the thorn of the piercing that gets right into the heart of the matter, and you know pierces your soul, you know resonates with you, influences you, goes right to your core, but also it's protection. The only form of fencing that existed at the time that this was being revealed that would describe fencing and protecting from marauding bad guys and from wild beasties was thorn bushes. And you'd put the thorn bushes up. You know, you even see some of these survival shows. They'll put thorn bushes around where they're going to sleep at night if they're in an area with predators.
Sure.
Same exact concept.
So it was just a multiple choice, but in the Christian things, always do it wrong.
Yes. Yeah, so when you check the Christian reference materials, you're going to see it both ways. And the reason I opted for the, since you have, because of Sarah, it's Yisrael. And Sarah means to engage and to endure, to contend and to strive. To be empowered by, and then El God, and Yish is individuals. But in this case, the individuals are the children with an inheritance that are part of the family, because it's Bene Yisrael.
Yeah. So
Yisrael is led by the hand of Yahweh, right? That's what the Yod is. In fact, Yod even means hand in Hebrew. It's Yod. But, hand. And then the sin, protected by, gets right to the heart, pierces right to the heart of the matter, the sin.
Mm-hmm.
The Raz, this for the first family as a priority, as for the observant individual.
Mm-hmm. The head. Uh-huh.
All right. And then it's led by the ram, which uses its head and its horns to protect its flock, defend its flock. Against all rivals and against predators, and the Lamed as a shepherd. So our shepherd is one with us.
Yeah. So that's to me it's pretty straightforward. I mean, it's pretty. I mean,
that's what it means. It's pretty. Yeah, it's pretty. It's very artistic language.
Yeah.
According to the children of Yisrael, by literally saying to them. All right, so now this is, by the way, and literally saying to them is La Amar again.
La Amar, which we covered before, but it's the lamb and the shelah, I mean.
Yeah, sure. La is the shepherd's staff.
Shepherd's staff again. And then the Amar, of course, is the Aleph for the A, and the Mem or for the M, and the Rosh, once again, the face, the head, rather, for the R. So we have La Amar and all the meanings that we've been covering. So,
all right, yeah, the shepherd's staff, leadership and authority. So this shepherd is one of us, one with us, protective, just like a ram is. One of the primary use of the ram's horns, and I think this is important, is to convey the full meaning of, because we've just not gone over this in a couple of days here, but the full meaning of that ram's horn is that the number one foe that a ram defends against using his horns. It's not wolves.
No.
It's not predators.
It's the competing ram head.
Right, competing ram. And so who's in competition with God?
Well, I'd say the adversary would be a good guess.
Right, and also all false gods.
All false gods.
False gods compete for human allegiance and attention, like Jesus Christ, like Allah. So the ram uses its horns, and it's depicted as a ram's horn to fend off rivals. It's the first statement that Yah etched in stone. You will not continue to exist with with another. You know, he says, my name is Yahweh. I am your savior. You know, I'm the one who led you out of Mitzrayim, of the crucible of human oppression. You will not exist with another. And so this is indicative of what a ram uses its horns for. It's not going to tolerate a rival. That's why he says, I'm a jealous God. It's why the first requirement to participate in the covenant is to walk away from Babylon, from religion and politics. Now, the second aspect of it is that the ram's horns were used by kings, by royalty of the day, to establish their leadership. And the ram's horn was the principal means used to make an announcement, to gain people's attention. It became the trumpet of the day. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of connotations that go along with the ram's horn beyond just protection and authority, the leader of the flock. And then, of course, it's combined with the lamed, the shepherd's staff. So here becomes what we were told to literally say to them. And I put literally before La Amar, because it was written in the call stem, and the infinitive absolute. The infinitive absolute makes the verb amar to speak, to communicate, to say, to answer, to promise, verbal noun. And the call stem means that this has literal implications. There's no nuanced meaning here. I want you to literally say this to them. Okay, that's the call stem is the most common stem in Hebrew, and it means that the relationship between the subject and the object is straightforward. This is actual, genuine, real, literal interpretation. I'm not trying to convey a nuanced meaning. I'm really just trying to tell you as it is.
Repeat after me.
Repeat after me. Yeah, repeat after me. There you go. Okay. So it begins with the Lord. No, it doesn't. It begins with Yahweh's name. Yahweh. He wants to kneel down in love, to continually bless you, desiring to lift you up forever for your benefit. Now, what's interesting here is the first use of Barak was it had Aaron, as enlightened free will, blessing the children of Yisrael by saying this. Okay? So, the first use of Barak was Moshe conveying on behalf of Yahweh a message to Aaron to consistently benefit and lift up Israel, Yisrael, the children of Yisrael, by literally saying this. And what is he saying? That Yahweh
Wants to do this.
Has decided to do this. That Yahweh wants to kneel down in love to continually bless you, desiring to lift you up forever for your benefit. So, you know, the Christian is saying, I'm searching for the will of God for my life. What's the will of God?
To do this.
Yeah. To kneel down before you.
I'm okay.
To lift you up.
Yeah.
Now, is he going to kneel down and lift up a religious person believing Pauline Christianity and doesn't know his name, doesn't even know who he is, and has rejected his Torah?
And he's going to address that a little further down, too.
Yeah.
Personal, so, proper name, yeah.
That's right. So, well, he began it already by saying, yeah.
Well, yeah, right. This is who I am, yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Not the Lord, not Jesus.
Duh.
Not Christ, not Allah, not any old God, Yahweh. Yahweh, he wants to kneel down in love to continually bless you, desiring to lift you up forever. Yeah.
I mean, that would make you just glow all day.
It should. Here's the creator God of the universe, and there's nothing he wants more than to get down on his knees to lift you up. Now, first of all, it screams, this God is really cool.
Yeah.
This God is the perfect dad. This wow. God is approachable. This God is engaged, trying to help me, benefit me, lift me up. This is not a God that's to be feared. This is not a God with a closed fist that's trying to push me down. This is the God that wants to lift me up.
Huh?
And it means this is a God that is not so insecure that he wants to be worshipped. This is a God who wants to show his love for me by lifting me up, as opposed to the stupidity of me getting down on my knees to lift him up. Wow.
Yeah.
Right perspective. It's exactly what you'd want God to be. And it's right here in his teaching. Yahweh, he has chosen. He wants to kneel down in love to continually bless you, desiring to lift you up forever for your benefit. Now, I added some words there, but I added the words to convey the conjugations and the mood. So there must be a conjugation here and a mood. The mood is the jussive. Jussive is third person volition. Who's third person in this? He. Who's he? Yahweh. So third person volition, we're talking about this is what God wants. It's his will. It's his desire. It's his choice. Oh, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
It's not just that God's willing to do this. He wants to do it.
Yes.
He has free will. He's chosen to do it.
Yeah.
This is what he wants to do. As a father, it's what we want to do, is to get down on our knees to lift our children up. And then it was written in the imperfect. What does that mean? Ongoing. Ongoing.
Gosh.
Yeah, ongoing.
Ongoing,
yeah.
Ongoing. Yeah. I'm sorry. Yes.
Continually. He doesn't want to just lift you up once and then drop you.
This is a state of being.
This is a state of being, man. He wants to continue to lift you up so that you're always uplifted, always loved.